VHF antennas on aircraft. I was never talking about VHF antenna. I was talking about an HF antenna. Has to be able to theoretically work from 2 to 30 megahertz. There's no problem with VHF antennas. In the old days, they used blade antennas, which are very broad. They are very easy to tune, and there's no problem with them. At the present time, for NAV and COM on VHF, they use printed antennas that are worked out, so they're also broadband antennas. And there's no problem with having to automatically compensate as they go across the aeronautical bands that they operate VOR and COM on. So this is not a problem. The problem is, where I also got involved was with broadcasting antennas, AM broadcasting, that runs 10 kilowatts. If you notice, in most AM broadcasting stations, there's what they call a doghouse. And in the doghouse, there's an antenna tuner. And the antenna tuner has to be adjusted for different weather conditions. I'll let it drop. Now, you would think that an AM broadcasting station that's licensed to transmit on only one frequency doesn't have the problem that hams have that want to transmit across ham bands that may be harmonically related or what, but they're wide in frequency. And even a good antenna might have to have some trimming to get the most efficient work to be done. I'm talking about broadcast antennas that use the 892 water-cooled tubes in parallel to drive power. And if you ever get near that doghouse, believe me, it's hot as hell in there. They have to have it, have fans on it to keep it cool. Now you guys are piddling around with a kilowatt or less, or maybe a kilowatt and a half if you run the legal limit. And you might not see how much heat is really, if it's only 5% of that, and it's a large antenna tuner, it's large because it has to have decent Q. And Q is reactance over resistance. One other way of talking about Q. So if you put the resistance in parallel with a coil, you lower the Q. I'll let it drop. And there's a book I have here. I can find it if I look. It's about installing broadcast transmitters on the AM bands. And it makes it perfectly clear that power is lost in the doghouse, even in a good installation, because the antennas, they may be long wires between towers, and their loading changes when the earth gets wet and things like that happen. So they're not a perfectly tuned load, and they have to be tuned. And we're dealing with enough power to see the heat build up. You guys are dealing with small amounts of power. You don't notice the heat build up. You have an antenna tuner that's large, so it can dissipate some power without really building up heat. It's also dissipating it in the form of radiant energy within the box, so you don't notice it. Back to you, Dick, from W2LP.
In the case of your HF broadcast antenna, which if you're operating during one of the low frequencies at the bottom of the band, roughly 560 KC, the wavelength is a darn big and your antenna isn't big enough, so a lot of impedance matching at the bottom of that antenna is required. But still, even at HF frequencies, even at high power HF, that doghouse with that tuner cannot lose power without turning it into heat. That if you had the ability to make the components large enough and low enough in loss at that power level, and by the way, the heat that you're talking about may have been 100 watts. Let me drop. Maybe 100 watts or 1,000 watts was continuously being lost in that doghouse when the main broadcast transmitter is running 10,000 or 20,000 watts. That's still a medium good efficiency. But even at HF frequencies, every bit of the insertion loss of that doghouse circuit showed up as heat. That if you could build that circuit with high enough quality so that it ran ice cold, even at HF frequencies, I say it has no ability, if you can keep it cold, not by cooling it, but you know what I mean. If you build it in such a way that it generates no heat, that there is no mechanism by which it can waste RF power, that it must obey that kind of conservation of energy. Am I wrong on that one, Bob? W2ILP, K2RIW. Wait for the beep.
K2RIW on the net, W2ILT. Well, you're wrong about one thing, but it's a minor nitpicking thing. Broadcast band is not on HF. It's on medium frequencies. From 300 kHz to 3 MHz is medium frequency. 3 to 30 is HF. So, I say that RF that's loaded inside the doghouse and doesn't really get efficiently radiated is now part of the antenna system, and it does get hot. The antenna wire gets hot too. That's why you have to use heavier antenna wire, and if you're using a coax transmission line, you would have to use a larger diameter coax to handle the power, or any of these other things, because there is an upheat generated due to IR losses, just like in any other power system. And that's why if you use a large enough component, the conductivity, because the RF runs more in the skin of the wire, but there's still, the heat conduction is similar to electrical conduction at low frequencies, and it is there. If you have this as part of the antenna, it's going to have heat, which is part of what's called radiation resistance, and it's also going to radiate in the doghouse. It may be only a small amount, depending on how much trimming it needs to do. I'll let it drop. Again, the amateur radio matchbox, it doesn't matter how long the transmission line is between the transceiver or transmitter and the matchbox. That's as long as it needs to be. But how long the connection is and what impedance it sees. Now these aircraft HF antennas don't use coax. They use a very short run of solid wire. It's insulated wire, but it doesn't have a shield. That's the way it runs. So that wire is part of the antenna as well. Back to you, Dick, from W2RLP.
Yes, that unshielded wire feeding power to that aircraft antenna certainly complicates things. But if now my doghouse at the base of this AM broadcast transmitting system was a shielded structure. I know it's not. It's usually a wooden house. But if it was a shielded structure so that it itself could not be part of the radiating system, It is a tuning system. And if I did a careful measurement while my broadcast transmitter is running, and I add up a total of 500 watts of dissipation of the components inside that doghouse, and assume the doghouse is shielded, if my transmitter is running 10,000 watts at the end of the transmission line feeding the doghouse, let me drop. So I get 10,000 watts at the far end of the transmission line at the input end of the doghouse. And the doghouse is dissipating 500 watts because I've measured the amount of heat given off by all of those components. And again, the doghouse is shielded. In that environment, 10,000 watts applied, 500 watts of heat, would you say, if I did that careful measurement, that I am now applying 9,500 watts to the base of that antenna? Do you agree with that, Bob? W2ILP, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, I agree with that. What I'm saying is there is some power that is lost in the doghouse. Naturally, they designed the system so it will be minimum. But as you recognize, it's hard to make an antenna at medium frequencies that will be long enough to be a perfect load. So they trim it. But they're not trimming it by a great deal. So there may be very little heat when they optimize this, and very little RF that's radiated by the components of the doghouse. But if they have to trim it for quite a bit, it could be appreciable. It's just a matter of how much they have to trim it. And obviously they're going to try to design an antenna that's close to resonant to the fixed frequency that they're operating on. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, I'm hearing the sound of some agreement, not perfect agreement, but some agreement among the people assembled here tonight explaining matchbox, transmitters, antennas, feed lines. I think we're seeing some agreement. Not perfect, but this is a controversial area, and for years and years, amateurs have had lots of strong opinions on this one. I have some more little puzzles I could add to this one and toss it around to the people, but I'm going to save that till next week. But what started this all off, to my knowledge, is that Mel has received over the years, over the months, over the last couple of weeks, a significant number of emails of people asking, please explain to me matchbox, Fallon, transmission line, but matchbox and Fallon. I think he's had a significant number of those. We've tossed it around quite a bit in the last...
I just want to make a comment.
Yeah, I'm going to pick you up, Wesley, after I go back to Mel first, because Mel started this all off last week or the week before. In your opinion, Mel, from the amount of discussion we've had in the last couple of weeks on matchbox, do you think that your particular email writing audience will be somewhat satisfied, or do you believe we should, in future weeks, go a little bit further with this one? K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, after the last article, did you happen to catch the new issue of QST and the discussion on radios over?
Yes, I did. I'm looking at it right now. And there is a mysterious graph in there which implies that as you make the radials longer, the efficiency goes down. I think that's one you're referring to, and that requires quite a bit of explanation. Is that the one you're referring to, Mel? Go ahead.
Exactly. I've been inundated by people asking me, what the heck does this all mean? They are so confused now with the radials, and how do you really assess? Do you need more radio? How much difference does adding a radio, how do you measure? You know, is it what is it? They just put it down and then fool around with the radio for a while and say, I think it's better. Do I need more? Do I need less? Am I overdoing it? Am I doing it right? It has caused more confusion than ever. I've been inundated with questions about radios, especially now, Dick, over.
Yeah, I'm looking at the February issue right now, and I'm looking at the wrong page. But I'm looking at that article. As soon as I find the darn thing, it has disappeared. The so-called antenna issue of February 2010. Or is it the March issue? Maybe I got the wrong one here. Anyhow, what I think is going on is that every realistic setup of an antenna over real ground, where the radials are either on the ground, buried in the ground, or above the ground, and is the antenna itself, the radiator, quarter wave, five-eighths wave, half wave, lots of variables involved, there is almost always a maximum elevation angle of radiation. Your particular setup, your number of radials, the length of your radials, the distance they are above the ground, the local conductivity of the ground, the size of your radiating system, the monopole itself in the center, you put that all together, maybe the best energy comes out of that antenna 20 degrees above the horizon. So, as you change the length of the radials, as you change the number of radials, you might be changing that elevation above the horizon, the peak of beam. And if the particular ionospheric condition today is such that you'll get the best communication between you and that guy in Chicago you want to talk to with a 30 degree elevation off the horizon, and your antenna is maximizing at 20, usually the other way around, by the way, you're not getting best efficiency for transmitting to him. So is that one of the phenomena going on? I'm going to have to go back to the article and study it a little bit more. It is, without a doubt, mysterious. It is sort of opposite of common sense if you just simply read that darn graph without further interpretation. I promised a week ago that I was going to read that article. I didn't do it. When you read the article itself, Mel, was there any explanation for that phenomenon, for that crazy curve, K2KEY, K2RIW?
Oh, and I think it's uncalled for because it has caused more confusion. I can only go by you. See, Dick, I have mountains of books like you on antennas. Stand 18 inches high, at least on a bookshelf, about 18 inches wide of books on antennas. Krauss, Walt Maxwell, you name it. Everybody's detailed work that Jerry Civic, W2FMI, did, etc., etc. And yet, you know, I've gone through the same situation of saying to myself, let me do my own experiment because I don't know. I'm reading too many things here that sometimes don't make sense. And there's, again, here's where the confusions come in. Because I have done experiments, and let me explain some of the experiments, and then we can continue from that point on. Hold on 1 minute. Let's quickly, let's take an antenna that I was always interested in, the band, the 160 meter band called the top band. And my problem was with radial, because I had a problem initially of going horizontal. You need a lot of real estate, you know, to put a nice dipole up, and you also need some supports that are considerably high. So I figured, okay, let me do it the old Marconi method. Now, I have to describe. Well, maybe I should let it go for a few minutes because I think I first have to describe in detail what a Marconi antenna is, Dick, over.
All right. And I had it coming as well.
I know. We got Wesley and Bob in that order, but go ahead and describe to us briefly a Marconi antenna and what you found. Go ahead, Eric. I mean, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW in the segment.
Okay, because I did not have the real estate initially at one time, the situation has changed that. But I put up an antenna. I had a vertical section going up about 35 feet. And then I had another horizontal section of 100 feet. And then at the bottom point, if you want to call it, originally it was just basically a ground rod in the ground that just drove into the ground. And I was measuring, I made some measurements at that time. I didn't even have the sophistication that I did. I have a surplus RF ammeter. I made it, you know, a resistance measurement, and I found I had 1 point with a hump out, with the power of, I tried to keep the power to reason, you know, under 100 watts at the time. And I measured 1.27 antenna current on the antenna line. So I used my Ohm's law, and I said, well, at 1.27 amperes, that I have a resistance of about under 50 ohms slightly, Dick. That was the beginning, and I said, well, where the heck is this goddamn current, the difference, going? Where am I losing it over?
That sounds like a tough one. Did you make further measurements or study and come to a conclusion, Mel? Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay, we'll get to everybody. Well, what did I make conclusion? I started fooling around. I was doing all kinds of things. I finally was able to, if you want to call it, change the system a little bit, because this grounding thing with the ground rod, it was a, you know, one of these 8-foot ground rods, a 9-foot ground rod driven into the ground at that point, you know, was not really, well, I guess, a good RF ground, so I figured I can sneak a couple of rings.
All right, let's go. I'm ready. KCHDRJ.
The radio field I wanted. And I brought the antenna current up by just adding a couple of radios, and I remember I kept to like 1.82 amps. Now my feed point resistance was about 24.2 ohms. It was a modest improvement because I was listening. My basic problem was I used to listen to the DX station on 160, and they would come in not too well. As I made improvements now on the radio system, it seemed like I picked up a few dBs definitely in listening to the, picking up the same DX stations I heard, Dick. But it still is nagging me why I couldn't do better. So I went to the analysis program, and I found something very interesting. Over.
Okay, you reset it, so go right ahead.
Okay. They said that with this trip, as close as I could, you know, model it, that in this type of soil conditions that we have, this proximity, this part of the world, I should expect about approximately a typical soil resistance of about 7.8 ohms. And my antenna current, I measured and worked out by resistance that I thought it was 24 ohms. I've got to remember everything. Okay, so there was a difference of like 16 ohms. So my antenna efficiency I worked out was only approximately about 30-some-odd percent, a little over 30%. That meant that out of, say, around 100 watts, a little less than that, I was actually radiating only about 25 watts. Do you agree? Over.
I think I do, and I think that's reasonable. Go ahead.
Okay, so I figured that 50, 60 watts or so of power, where was it going? I was warming the worms up, as you always say. The earthworms were very happy. And that means I was looking at, well, if I wanted to equate it, that means I'm actually looking at approximately, well, a 4 dB signal loss in reception. That's why I said, the DX stations are not coming in the way it was. So I looked at antenna modeling. What do you do? And the good thing that they showed, why not go to a multi-wire system? In other words, a twin lead. Use twin lead, like 300 ohm twin lead, and, you know, in the configuration of the Marconi twin lead system. Do I have to, you know, go into more details on that? Over.
You might want to give a quick description of what a twin lead Marconi antenna looks like. Wait for the beep.
television wire, 300 ohm wire. I went up 35 feet. I went across approximately 100 feet. I then took the two ends of that piece of wire, the 300 ohm wire, I shorted it. At the bottom, the base section of it, I took one lead and I connected it to the ground rod system. And the other point I used as a feed point, Dick, over.
Feed point meaning the transmitter was connected there?
Exactly. So then I figured, well, okay, now the impedance, I figured, would give me a step-up impedance of about 4. And that means that if I had 7.8 ohms originally, and I multiplied it by 4, I figured I should be now about 31, lower 31 ohms. But my ground resistance, I know I wasn't going to really affect it, which I actually figured out at 16 ohms, but I figured my efficiency now should be about 66%. That means I should have picked up approximately about 3 dB. Correct? Over.
Hey, I see a little bit of a problem now. You're getting a kind of a folded dipole-like structure, which means that the impedance that you see goes up. But the real radiation resistance component of that monopole-like thing or Marconi-like thing didn't change. You changed the way you're feeding it, but the thing that's really doing the radiating, you didn't make a substantial change to it. So I'm not convinced that that's going to change the radiation efficiency. In order for an antenna, a vertical ground plane antenna, if that's what we were testing and you're not, but if it was a vertical ground plane antenna, in order for it to be essentially 100% efficient, it should be built above a solid sheet of copper that goes out multiple wavelengths in all directions from the radiator feed point. None of us can do that. We build a much more skeleton-like structure by way of the ground radials that we set down. Let me drop.
Comment.
I recognize. So we lay down some number of radials. And the whole reason there is that we'd like to lay down radials close enough so that the RF energy in its wavelengths can't squeeze between those radials and see very much of the Earth. Any RF energy that gets coupled into Earth sees a volumetric, slightly lossy material and heats up the worms, as we've been saying. So we make some kind of a compromise there in the number of radials we can lay down and where we put those radials. So I'm about to guess, Mel, that if you made that change in the way you fed it, that when you did a similar experiment with a guy listening to you, and here we got the ionosphere problem, but if it was a guy 5 blocks away and it was a direct line of sight signal, and he's running a attenuator in front of his receiver to be sure he's not exceeding its dynamic range, and he really can read the S-meter, I'm a little bit afraid that you didn't see a great significant transmitted efficiency when you made that change. That's a guess on my part. I wonder what you saw. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, I'm going by received signal. This is my whole emphasis is going through all this radio remote was not because I was using it originally. I was not looking for any kind of a NVIS situation on 160. I wanted to work 160 DX, trying to get my DXCC on 160, my last band to do it on. And I was figuring all kinds, and I hear the stations, the DX stations, I hear people working them, mostly guys, nobody in Brooklyn area, nobody in Brooklyn ever got 160 DXCC. So they never had the facility to put up a 160 antenna that would really be a DX chaser. So that was my whole goal. But I heard people working them that were living upstate New York, and I heard the description of their antennas between two, dipoles up 125 feet on a 50-foot cut, trees available. I didn't have that. So what this was really what my goal was. I first wanted to be able to hear the stations. I could not really hear them. That's it. No use trying to work them if you can't hear them. Let me let it drop and then I'll tell you what I did. Fit with the program again. Mini neck again. I got an idea. I said, I looked up. I said, you know, what was very popular during World War II, here we go back before World War II, was this three-wire system where you use three wires with a spreader between them. They called it a cage antenna, but it was not really a so-called how to be in a cage configuration. In fact, they used to sell spreaders for making cage antennas with kept the wires at 120 degrees apart. So I went ahead and I made my own system up, but I didn't make it. I now have made up a three-wire system, Dick. And here's what I figured. If I took that 7.8 ohm figure originally with the 300 ohm wire, and then I made this other system up, I would have something like 7.8 now times 11, and I'd get to maybe around 85 ohms. And that would make my antenna efficiency, if I did the math, somewhere up around 85%, which would translate to a 4 dB boost. And this is what I found I modeled. Go ahead.
So did you make a change, and did you start hearing these 160 meter DX stations? By the way, the first time I looked up the word Marconi antenna on the internet, I'm seeing something that looks awfully close to a vertical ground plane quarter wave antenna. But maybe I found the wrong website. Over to you.
Well, actually, if you took the vertical section of this antenna and the horizontal section, you know, it put the two pieces together and measured the distance, comes out to about 135 feet, which is approximately a quarter wavelength on 160. So now I had this three-wire system up there with the three wires coming down. How I did it is I took the ends. Remember I did it with the 300 ohm wire? I connected the ends together. I did the same thing. I connected all three wires together at the first far end about 100 feet away. I brought now the three wires over, and now I fed the three wires straight down, and at the bottom with three more wires. In other words, I have three going across. They are joined at one end, at the far end, brought down, dropped down three wires. I took two of the wires, connected them together, and left the third wire, which was the middle, probably like the middle wire. The third wire I used as my feed point. I took the two wires of the three-wire system on the bottom, and that went to my ground system. And I'll tell you the truth, Dick, I started hearing DX stations. I started working them. And then not only that, I called CQ sometimes, and they came back to me, DX stations, because they have seldom had any contact at all, most of them told me, with where I am, Kings County, over.
Sure sounds like a success story. I know you've also strung a dipole on 160 meters across multiple homes in your neighborhood. We're going to hear about that on the next transmission, but we've got the Wesley and Bob in that order who wanted to make comments on all that has occurred so far. N2XJN first. K2RIW, wait for the beep and watch you watch.
Okay, November, to X-ray, Juliet, November. I was listening to this conversation. It's very much interesting. I'm very much in respect to the knowledge of them. I'm sorry, not them. Gosh, I'm getting old. Have on the end of the tongue, the gentleman. And this guy actually spent his whole life analyzing the antennas. He's a great person, but it's not what I was trying to talk about. Let me drop for a moment.
Yeah, that was Mel that was just doing the talking. You got it, Wesley.
Mel, I'm sorry for just... I was trying to say Mel, I say Glenn. Your knowledge is absolutely outstanding, and I do have a great respect to Dick, but it's not what I was trying to say. What I was trying to say is many people, not all of them, do not realize that you do not need antenna tuner, and that is quite challenging what I'm saying right now, because it's a fact the new technology came in, you right now need the antenna tuner, but in old times, the antenna tuner was your amplifier. When I was talking about how close is antenna tuner to the amplifier, I wasn't talking about the distance, I was talking about electrical principles. That means that if you add the tube to antenna tuner, you have now amplifier. Each amplifier has, you know, of the old times, has the P network. I remind myself the P networks, right? And that is your antenna tuner. So, guys, instead of spending $600-$700 on a good antenna tuner, the one from Tokyo, which is one of the best, goes for $1,400-$1,500, go for a cheap amplifier. It's going to make an impact on your power, and it's going to make them the same as the antenna tuner does. Another thing that I'm a little bit disappointed, Dick, with all the respect that I have for you, is that you cut short the conversation about photons. Just because one thing that I do not understand is that if photons are utilized as the carriers of magnetic field, not electromagnetic field, magnetic field, at the same time photons are utilized as the carriers of electromagnetic fields, and one is talking going through the straight lines that doesn't have a mass or might have a slight mass, then why then gravity goes through the curved lines? And then we're talking about the electromagnetic waves. For some strange reasons, the long waves, they're supposed to have a greater mass, if there is any mass, are simply going 300 miles along the path of the Earth. And the electrical horizon is just 15 kilometers. It's just when you take one, let me jump for a moment. If you take the antenna of the height of 1 meter, to the point that antenna, that this path meets the ground, is 15 kilometers. So, actually it is not. It was explained this way. From 1 meter to 1 meter, along the curvature of the Earth, there is a 15 kilometers. So, when you take the shorter waves, 10 meters waves, they happen to just fly. And these waves actually can be reflected through ionosphere and stratosphere. Everything much. And all of this mess with quantum theory that was actually very much questioned by Albert Einstein is just for me unexplained. Back to you, Dick and Duke Jen.
I'm trying to remember what was the first subject. Oh, my mind's gone blank. What was the first subject that Wesley just talked about?
I said that each amplifier is an antenna tuner.
My goodness, absolutely right. In the old days of a Collins transmitter, a Heathkit DX100, a Johnson Viking 2, in the old days, you had a real tuning and loading control in the transmitter. Even on the what's the model number on the one I'm looking at? TS-520. Many of the older, larger transmitters had the antenna tuner, as Wesley is saying, built into it, the matchbox built into it. The Pi network, he calls it a P network, but it's a Pi network, is the way we tend to pronounce it. You had a real loading control, a tuning control, and an inductor in there. And that transmitter of old, the larger type, which you can buy in the surplus market, most of them will probably take at least a 6-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna of almost any phase angle. You properly set those tuning and loading controls, and on most of those bands, you'll get a perfect match. The Pi network, the tank circuit on that transmitter, let me drop, is the impedance match between the antenna and your feed line. It's no different than what the matchbox is doing. Because we have all seemed to insist on the transmitter being a compact box and a so-called no-tune transmitter, because we in the past voted with our pocketbook and forced Southeast Asia transmitter manufacturers to do that. They gave us what we thought we wanted, a no-tune transmitter, great sounding on the advertisement, and the boxes were a comeback. That's the good news. The bad news is you can't exceed something like a 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio, and your no-tune transmitter goes crazy. So now they resell you back that Pi network by way of the matchbox. And yes, it's kind of crazy. It would all be in one box if you hadn't insisted on it being a no-tune compact box. Buy an old enough transmitter, and you're getting the matchbox, the antenna tuner, built in automatically. Because what's really going on, to repeat what I've said many times, let me drop. Our transmitter, antenna, and feed line is a radiating system. And you're going to resonate an impedance match that radiating system, consisting of antenna, maybe some kind of a tuner at the antenna, a transmission line, maybe some kind of a matchbox in the shack, the transmitter's tank circuit, and the final tube or the final transistor. That combination, you're going to resonate before you radiate well. And if the feed line is low enough in loss, you can put any of those components anywhere you want. And you used to have that built into the transmitter. The tuner was there. So it's a little bit similar to what happens with a not-so-honest general contractor. You buy a piece of land, you want him to build your house. The first thing he does is to mow down all the trees and take away all the topsoil. That makes it nice and convenient for him to run all of his machinery, to dig the foundation, and to set up the house. Then he sells you back landscaping, and he sells you back your topsoil, which was originally there. So he takes it away and he sells it back. And in the case of our transmitters, the so-called no-tune transmitters, we took away the antenna tuner that used to be there, and now they're selling it back to us. It's kind of crazy once you look at the great big picture. And I'm not going to go into the photons right now, Wesley. There's only a certain amount of that that this audience can take. And we're going to give it to them in pieces each night, but I'm not going to go into that too much now. I know that Bob wanted to make some comments. W2ILP. Wait for the beep, Bob, and watch your watch. K2RIW. You got it, Bob.
And WS2N.
K2R.
Paul recognized.
And that, this is W2ILP. And talking about vertical antenna radials, which was a subject that was brought up here. So I want to continue talking about it. When I lived in the Bronx, New York City, North Bronx, I lived in a two-family house when I first got married that was owned by someone else who lived on the ground floor, and I lived on the upper floor. And my rig, at that time, I was interested in 20-meter DX. I had an HW32, which was a heated 20-meter single sideband mono. And I was driving an HA14, which was the mobile or fixed station kilowatt linear, which really wasn't a kilowatt, but was almost. And I put up a vertical antenna on the roof. The roof was accessible, it was a flat roof. It wasn't easily accessible because I had to go up through a trap door. And I put up this vertical and I decided I'd need some radials, so I just ran three radials from it. And I went down to the shack and started to operate without any antenna tuner or anything else. And what was happening is I was getting RF in the shack. In other words, the coax had RF on it, and that's where it goes if you don't have a good counterpoise for a vertical antenna, because you really want to simulate the phantom ground regardless of how high the antenna itself is. And so the radials were not doing the job. And at that time, I was a very avid DXer, which I'm not now. I'll let it drop. This is W2ILP again, and I decided to tell the landlord, after consulting with some other engineering hams, I was going to buy some conductive aluminum paint and paint the entire flat roof with conductive aluminum paint, which I did. Never could do it now. In those days, I was able to do anything if it was possible. I did it. And after I achieved almost what Dick was saying, because the optimum would be to create a large, solid ground plane around your antenna. Well, after I got that on, I started working DX like crazy, and some ham in New Jersey said to me, he said, "You're unfair in the pileups, because we work directional beams, and you got your vertical, and you're blocking all these other guys out on both sides because you have a omnidirectional antenna, and we have to take time to rotate, and you're getting the DX before we can in the pileup, but you're unfair. I'll let it drop." Hello, this is W2ILP again. And the reason he said I was unfair, he said I was unsportsmanlike to use a vertical. I was just like the guys who go fishing with a tie drop line instead of a rod and reel. I wasn't using what everybody else was using, and I had an unfair advantage. But the vertical has a beautiful angle of radiation, and when you get it balanced to ground, you get no RF in the shack, and you get a pretty good match. I didn't use any antenna tuner aside from what's in the rig. Now I'm talking to you using a IC706, which is very popular, and it also covers all the HF bands. And I use a 40-meter dipole with no antenna tuner, because it is close to being a resonant load, has a reasonable visor, and doesn't cause the radio to go into protect mode. I'll let it drop.
WA2SAY calling.
About time.
The center of my dipole has bound. When I was working for Collins, I did some extensive measurements with balance, feeding them from a well-calibrated signal generator, and actually getting the RF output accurately measured. What was really interesting is at 30 megahertz, the balance worked without any loss. As soon as I exceeded 30 megahertz, the balance put in a tremendous attenuation, which proved to me that it was an excellent TVI filter, as well as being a balun. It was a W2AU balun. And when I opened it up years later, I found it had completely air core coils. There was no ferrite core or anything like that. So with that, back to you, Dick, from W2ILP.
Fantastic. Sounds like you had a very nice antenna there in the Bronx. You also had an extremely friendly landlord or supervisor of the building that would allow you to paint the whole roof with aluminum conductive paint to make a better ground plane for your antenna. My goodness, were you in a friendly environment. Either that or they never found out. Doug, to the A2SAY recognized. You got one person ahead of you that wants to make comment, and that's WS2N. And I'm going to go back over to Doug. Go ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Doug, yeah, I had an unrelated question So you were finishing up with that. So if you're going to continue on, I guess I'll delay.
Now, let me finish through this, Dick, KTKEY.
Go ahead, Bill. I finished the subject. Then I'm going to go over to Doug because I think he wants to make a comment on what we've heard so far. K2KEY for now. K2RIW.
Okay, let me clarify one more thing. With like a Marconi quarter wave, let me just explain one more thing because I know I'm going to be questioned. The vertical section of the Marconi antenna, as you go ahead and you lengthen the vertical section, what happens is the feed point resistance will begin to rise. It does have a cutoff. In other words, once you get this antenna, we're talking about vertical antennas, this is not really purely in a vertical. It has a flat top and all. So, as the flat top gets shorter and the vertical piece gets longer, the impedance is going to go up. But if you go ahead and you get this antenna perfectly vertical, in other words, eliminate the back, the flat top, there is actually if you took a single wire and you go ahead and you put it perfectly vertical, you will supposedly approach a point of 37 ohms. That's the limit. See, that of course limits the point where it's no longer a Marconi antenna and now is a vertical antenna. So I want to clarify that. At the point when you've got a straight wire, the theoretical feed point resistance now is going to be about 37 ohms. And this is what you do with the Marconi. You can adjust your feed point to some extent by changing the relationship of the vertical to the horizontal section. I mean, I hope I made that clear, Dick. Go ahead.
Yes, I think you have. And when you Google the word Marconi antenna, you don't get a straight answer. I think I'm going to go to the antenna book, ARL antenna book, or to JASIC's antenna engineering handbook, or one of the later versions, to really find out what a Marconi is. But when you change the length of a monopole or a length of a dipole, you're simultaneously changing the resistive component and the reactive component in deterministic, predictable ways. In the case of a simple monopole or dipole where there's no bending of the wire, the Brown and Woodward curves will tell you exactly what's going on. As I told you before, you can always find them at amateurradio.tangovictor. www.amateurradio.tangovictor.tv. And there you're going to find the Brown and Woodward curves. Now, once you have that flat top section of the Marconi antenna, and you adjust the ratio between the vertical and the horizontal, you've got another variable available to you. I wonder, Doug, have you ever built a Marconi-like antenna? I know you did build a directional discontinuity ring radiator once out in Center Reach. Yeah, I think it was Center Reach. Sheldon, Center Reach area. And I think you might be coming in on the 147-375 machine. From the A2SIY, long time no here. KQRIW on the TechNet. You've got it, Doug.
Good evening, Dick, and everybody else that's here. Yes, I'm on the Zeldin machine with my little indoor vertical antenna, that door I can hear. I want to go back a little bit to when you were talking about the built-in antenna matcher. Yes, I know what you're talking about exactly because I'm familiar with all the old tube radios. But you may have led some of the modern people astray. The modern ham is looking to put a square meter in his line between the antenna connection of the radio and his antenna. And if he puts that square meter in his line and then he tunes his old tube-type transmitter, he tunes the load and the match to maximum RF out or maximum or minimum, to be a dip in the plate current, whatever. He's still not going to see a good SWR in his square meter, so you ought to make that clear to everybody that with the old tube type transmitter, yeah, you can match a lot of different kinds of antennas, a lot of different mismatches, but you can't measure what you're doing. Back to net.
I prefer you go to that. Want to add something. If you could say a few words about the amplifiers. Well, good antenna tuner costs as much as 200-300 watt amplifier. The ratio is 6-1. Yes, I agree with that. Now you have a good antenna tuner, a good amplifier. What is the sense of the odds and nonsense of just buying antenna tuner? And to XJF.
Yeah, I was flipping back and forth between the 375 machine and the 85 machine, and I could cord in between. That's why the delay there. Doug, you're absolutely right. And again, this is going to be another one of those controversial areas, not easily understood, often misunderstood. Because we have, over the last decade or so, insisted on a compact transmitter, you don't have the room in the box for the great big Pi network and the output that used to be there when it was tubes. And there's an equivalent circuit that you use with transistors. It happens not to be a Pi. It's more like a T, but it doesn't matter. You don't have the size of the variable components, and the tune-up procedure for rigs like a Kenwood 520 or a Johnson Viking 2 or KWM1, any of the Collins transmitters. The classic rigs that had a Pi network with a tuning and loading control in the transmitter box. Let me drop. Those rigs can match extremely high standing wave ratios by modern standards. A 6-1 is easy, a 10-1 is possible, and at certain phase angles, it would probably even match a 20-1 standing wave ratio.
At 8 o'clock, this is the WQVL repeater.
It's advertising the 8 o'clock net. Chap, thinking of going to that. Okay.
Complete.
That's the good news. It would tolerate these great big visuars. But if you're using your standing wave ratio meter or your bird watt meter in that transmission line, no change in standing wave ratio is occurring. That's what Doug is saying. You're going to be a bit confused if you use that rig. When you adjust the tuning and loading control of that transmitter, you're making the tube happy. It sees the right impedance of the final stage of the transistor amplifier. You're making it happy. It sees the right impedance. But it makes no change to the antenna itself. That antenna has a certain standing wave ratio at the antenna. That dictates what percentage of power or voltage, whichever you want to consider, that gets re-reflected down the line on the inside of the transmission line, if you're using a good balancing device up there. But some amount of power is going to be reflected back. As you adjust that tuning and loading control for best characteristic of that transmitter, you are maximizing the power that gets delivered to the antenna. That's the good news. But you do not change the visuar. When you have a completely separate antenna tuner, and you put your visuar measuring device between your exciter and the antenna tuner, let me call it matchbox. Yes, you can adjust that for a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. In the old-fashioned transmitter, let me drop. In the old-fashioned transmitter, they didn't do it, but they could have given you a standing wave ratio meter between the final plate circuit of the tube and that Pi network. And if that particular tube gives best performance when it's loaded with 3,500 ohms of resistance and resonated, you could, in theory, put a 3,500 ohm standing wave ratio meter inside of that transmitter and adjust those tuning and loading controls to make that tube happy. We thought we didn't need that. We thought all we needed is some kind of an output voltage or output current indicator and maximize the power delivered to the transmission line at that frequency. That was good enough. So yes, there's confusion. And even when you use that matchbox and you locate your visuar measuring device in between the transmitter and the matchbox, and you see a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, you've made the transmitter happy, you've made no real change to the antenna. The antenna still has the exact same biswire.